From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite. Today on the show, our Project Milwaukee series, Black Men in Prison, continues with some national context for the discussion. Later, amid the growth in young professional organizations in Milwaukee, a conversation about what these groups actually set out to do.
They're a hard thing to define. They'll describe themselves as a group that activates talent and space to promote the city, and in some respects, they're sort of a civic organization. They see themselves as promoting the new guard of the city.
Plus, a remembrance of one member of the old guard. And Irish stand-up comic Dylan Moran looks across the Atlantic for material.
Not everybody's talking about Britain or France or Japan, you know, but everybody talks about America because if you scratch your left ear, it has big consequences all around the world.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tite. Thank you so much for being with us today. This month, WUWM and Milwaukee Public Television began a six-month collaboration examining the issue of incarceration among black men in Wisconsin. The state has the highest rate in the country, and Milwaukee County's numbers are even higher. More than half of African-American men in their 30s have spent time behind bars. But racial disparities exist nationally as well, and the national data offers some context for the situation in Wisconsin. The Washington, D.C.-based group The Sentencing Project tracks incarceration statistics and makes policy recommendations aimed at reducing incarceration levels nationwide. Mark Maurer is the group's executive director, and he joins us this morning by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Can you give us a national snapshot of the issue, especially of race and incarceration?
Well, you know, as we've seen the prison explosion of the last four decades, we now have about seven times as many people in our prison system as we did in the early 1970s. We've also seen enormous racial disparities in the use of incarceration. African Americans are incarcerated roughly six to seven times the rate of white Americans, Latinos about two and a half times the rate of white Americans. And you know, this comes at a point where U.S. incarceration rates are actually in the world lead of how we imprison our people. So we're both the most incarcerating nation. And then if we look at racial ethnic minorities, those figures are dramatically higher even than the national averages.
Is it possible to point to crimes and say this is a particular case where a white person would not be sentenced or would be sentenced at a lower rate than a person of color?
Well, it's a complicated story, and I think it's not just one where we can look at a certain point in the justice system, say, on the day of sentencing. You know, there are many studies that look at, say, a white burglar and a black burglar on the day of sentencing, and, you know, do they get the same sentence in prison or in the community? And some studies say yes, and some studies say no, there's little difference or so. But I think what we do know is that there's very much a cumulative effect of how cases are processed in the justice system. So decisions made by law enforcement on who to arrest, by prosecutors, what kind of charges, by the quality of your defense attorney, judicial decisions, each decision-making point may have an impact on the outcome of those cases. So I think we need to look at the sort of totality of decision-making to try to get a feel for how that plays out.
What got us to this point? The data shows, as you point out, that imprisonment rates and racial disparities also did not always look like this.
Right. Well, I think we've seen, you know, this explosion in incarceration. And just to be clear, you know, most people in prison have committed crimes and they've been convicted of that. Occasionally there's some innocent people, but most of the people have been convicted of violating the law. I think it's two parts in some ways. One is that, you know, public safety is traditionally a function of a variety of institutions. So it's family upbringing, it's community supports, it's education, it's access to opportunity, and it's also criminal justice initiatives. And what's happened in recent decades is that I think we've gotten very much out of balance, that we've come to rely very heavily on the criminal justice system as our primary response to disorder, misbehavior, particularly in low-income communities of color. And in many respects, that set up a vicious cycle. As we pour more resources into the back end of the system, there's consequently less available up front for prevention, interventions, treatment initiatives that might head off the cycle of crime in the first place. We also have policies like, you know, tough on crime sentencing, the war on drugs, which have really exacerbated these figures and in many cases contributed to the racial disparities we're seeing as well.
But you would contend that just blaming, say, the Rockefeller drug laws or the three strikes and you're out kinds of policies maybe oversimplifies the problem?
Well, yes, I do. I think it's a broad problem. You know, many of the policies adopted in the last couple of decades and many of them growing out of the war on drugs have really made things considerably worse. California's three strikes and you're out policy, for example, just a couple of cases from there went to the Supreme Court. One man, his third strike was stealing three golf clubs from a sporting goods store. Another man, his third strike was stealing $153 of videotapes. The golf club thief was sentenced to 25 to life. The videotape thief, 50 to life. And these were sentences that were upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, which did not find that they represented cruel and unusual punishment. So clearly, we shouldn't condone people stealing golf clubs and videotapes. You know, whether this is a wise, let alone compassionate policy is a very different question.
What would you contend is the right role for prison to play in general in terms of the people who commit crimes, the victims of crime in society at large?
Well, I think what's often forgotten in some of the discussion is that 95% of the people we send to prison are coming home someday. Some will come home in a year, some in 20 years. But, you know, if all we care about is vengeance and punishment, we're selling ourselves short, I think. You know, it's in everyone's interest that when people come home from prison, they be better equipped, better prepared to make it legitimately in the community than before they were sent there. And, you know, in many respects, we've done just the opposite of what's needed in recent decades. As we've piled up the numbers in prison, the relatively limited programming that's always been available in prison in many ways is getting stretched even further. So opportunities for education, vocational training, substance abuse, counseling, and treatment are very modest in general, given the scale of the problem. So we take people from disadvantaged communities with many factors that at least contribute to their becoming involved in crime. If we don't address them very constructively, then all we've done is incapacitate people at a huge expense with little positive impact on their doing better once they get out of prison.
As you say, it doesn't seem like there is one single point of failure along the way, but where do you see enforcement fitting in this equation?
Well, I think, you know, police, you know, as do other actors in the justice system, you know, have a great deal of discretion available to them. And there's nothing wrong with that. Decisions need to be made all the time. But how that discretion is employed, we see this, you know, most clearly in the war on drugs, which, you know, has ramped up dramatically since the mid-1980s with pretty strong racially disparate outcomes. Essentially, we have really a two-tiered war on drugs. When parents in middle-income communities discover their teenage son or daughter has a drug problem, they don't call up the police and demand that their kid be arrested. They try to get their child into the best treatment program they can find. When similar problems come up in low-income communities, those same resources are not available, and so it's much more likely to become a criminal justice problem. And so we throw police and prosecutors in prison cells at the problem there. So we have some very similar problems, but in many cases, we approach in very different ways, depending on really family and community resources available to try to address that issue.
You recently co-authored an op-ed in the Washington Times about this issue, and you pointed to the example of a man who essentially facilitated a drug deal and got a disproportionately stiff sentence compared to the other people that were involved. How is that particular example emblematic of what you see as wrong with the system?
Well, the case of Clarence Aaron was a football player at Southern University in the early 1990s. His crime involved he introduced one of his friends at school to an old high school friend who was a cocaine dealer, and it led to the sale of about 20 pounds of cocaine, a substantial amount. Clarence Aaron, the sort of go-between, didn't buy or sell or supply any of the drugs, but he refused to testify against the other people, refused to take a plea deal he'd been offered, and he ended up getting the most extreme penalty. He was sentenced to 3 life terms without parole. This was his first conviction. So he's been serving that sentence now for more than 20 years. This is an outgrowth of the federal mandatory penalties established for drug offenses back in the 1980s, you know, applying very harsh penalties based on the quantity of drugs, and that do not permit the judge to have any discretion into taking account his relative role in the drug trade, changes in his behavior, orientation while he's in prison, and the like. And the only way that Clarence Aaron can ever get out would be if he gets a commutation from the president. And commutations are extremely difficult to get at the moment, certainly. And so even though he's done all the right things one could expect in prison, he's still looking at spending the rest of his life behind bars for that one drug transaction.
Speaking of the president, the attorney general is basically working with states around the country to look at the issue of mandatory minimums. Do you think that effort is starting to tackle the right questions?
I think there's no question we're starting to see a change in the political climate on these issues. Attorney General Holder this summer delivered a high-profile speech in which he said there are now too many people in too many prisons for far too long. Pretty remarkable words coming from the Attorney General. And he and many other leaders of both parties have been very critical of the excessive use of mandatory penalties and how they've really distorted our sentencing policies and led to incarceration. Most notably, we're seeing now in Congress, which is, you know, quite well known for not exactly being very bipartisan these days. In the Senate, the Judiciary Committee is about to hear 2 bills that would reform mandatory sentencing, scale back the severity of those penalties. And what's most intriguing is the sponsorship of those bills.
Where do you think this falls as a campaign issue in the midterm elections?
Well, I don't think that criminal justice reform will necessarily be a high priority for most politicians, but probably more importantly, neither will tough on crime initiatives be a high priority. You know, we had a period in the 80s and 90s, the height of the war on drugs, where many political people, ranging from presidential candidates on down, were campaigning on how tough they could be on crime and drugs. That era is pretty much over now. There's been a real shift in the climate. More and more political leaders are now recognizing we need a more balanced approach. We need to deal with drug issues that in ways that involve prevention, treatment. So I think that the absence of any of that rhetoric on the campaign trail should continue to embolden people like we see in the Senate who feel a certain comfort level in going ahead with mandatory sentencing reform with less fear that they may be attacked for being soft on crime as they would have felt previously.
Are there examples that you see of states that are starting to reverse engineer the system with some success?
Well, we've seen some significant shifts in recent years. In the last 3 years, the prison population nationally has actually declined modestly. It's a very small shift, but compared to the preceding 4 decades, it's significant. And in 3 states, New York, New Jersey, California, there's been actually a 20% decline in their prison population over the last decade. In New York and New Jersey in particular, this has been a fairly conscious shift involving changes in policy. So New York scaling back the Rockefeller drug laws, harsh mandatory sentencing, also providing incentives for sentence reductions by participating in programs in prison. In New Jersey, rather than sending everyone back to prison who might have committed an infraction while on parole supervision, there's now more scrutiny of them, more use of halfway houses as a way to deal with the behavior that's short of imposing new prison terms. So some of this is sort of day-to-day shifts by practitioners who are looking at prison as a very expensive resource, essentially saying, how can we reduce the sort of excessive use of incarceration? How do we reserve it for cases in which protecting the public is necessary, but we shouldn't be doing it just because we're mad at these people who broke the laws. We should be figuring out, you know, what ways we can change their behavior while also supervising them appropriately in the community.
Mark Maurer, thanks so much for helping us put this conversation in a national context.
And thanks for having me, too.
Mark Maurer is executive director of the Sentencing Project based in Washington, D.C. You can find links to the group's national data on incarceration rates, plus more from our Project Milwaukee series, Black Men in Prison, at WUWM.com. We'll take a quick break and in just a moment get some insight into the sometimes nebulous and confusing world of young professional organizations in Milwaukee. What are they trying to accomplish? This is Lake Effect from WUWM. It's a Like Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. The organization known as Newwaukee entered the scene 4 years ago, and over that time has connected thousands of Milwaukee's young professionals. And they're one of a growing number of groups that's shaking up the conventional means by which people network here. An article in the December issue of Milwaukee Magazine, though, tries to delve into the sometimes complex ultimate goal of Newwaukee and the other young professional organizations, and it also looks at how they coordinate and how they compete. The article was written by Associate Editor Matt Rohde, who is with us in the studio to share the insights he gathered. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Let's start with a big question that this article takes a crack at. What is the ultimate aim of Newwaukee?
It started out mostly as a social organization, a young professional group that would get together. The first event was Ian Abson invited a number of friends, and a friend of his sort of roped together some acquaintances, and they met at a bar. So it started out as a social organization in 2009 that was holding different events, and they've kind of slowly gotten more ambitious over the years and pulled in more of what seems like professional development. And they're a hard thing to define. They'll describe themselves as a group that activates talent and space to promote the city. And in some respects, they're sort of a civic organization. They see themselves as promoting the new guard of the city, the young creative blood, and almost sort of like a transfusion of San Francisco-style ethos. But they've kind of grown
They've built momentum simply by building momentum in some ways.
Right, right. They said we always want people to be, when we do stuff, we always want people to be talking about it. And probably their greatest strength lies in social media. They have some of the longest subscriber lists in the city and in the country, actually, for groups of their kind. And they've gotten more ambitious, and the city leaders have started looking to them, you know, to carry more weight for civic leadership. And they've been pretty close with Tom Barrett in the past couple years. And now they're starting to get into art. What is Milwaukee's art identity?
Well, and you know, they don't have their membership model isn't perhaps, you know, the typical, you know, fill out a form and, you know, get a membership card at the end of the day. What do they think in terms of how many people are actually part of this group?
They claim a grand total of 40,000 followers / subscribers, and that's people on email lists, Twitter followers, Facebook likes, and they don't maintain a paid membership. There are other groups in town like Fuel Milwaukee that are more corporate networking groups, and so your company would pay a fee for you to be a member. Then you could attend, you know, events at 6 p.m. to have a couple drinks and throw around some business cards and do some other networking type things. And but Milwaukee has always been kind of more amorphous and blobby. It kind of allows them some flexibility, but they also sort of have to keep the buzz temperature high enough that they can kind of keep the static cling going.
Well, and you, so you said the city leaders are really starting to pay attention to this group, as you might imagine, if, you know, any group with 40,000 young professionals would start to generate some static cling.
Right. I mean, people have seen Milwaukee as being sort of hollowed out from the inside. Manufacturing left, and we did a feature a couple of years ago about the new economy and what's going to be the new economy, Wisconsin's Technology Council trying to throw money around and fill some of the gaps in angel investing and all this venture capital kind of stuff. And a lot of arts organizations are dedicating some pretty serious resources and putting key people like an artistic director on Art Milwaukee, you know, for no pay. And these are people that probably were brought from outside of the city, talented people to lead an organization like the Milwaukee Rep, who are spending, one guy told me, 10 hours a month, you know, for doing work for free for Art Milwaukee. And it's because they have, you know, lists that can stir up 200 or 300 people at a bar at some kind of event for a nonprofit overnight. Well, I guess this has been attractive, and they've kind of been seduced to a degree by this.
Well, at the end of the day, do you get the sense for what, you know, what an organization like the Milwaukee Rep or really anybody is hoping comes out of this? What the product is, or what the end result is from being involved with a group like Milwaukee?
They want some more of those young people to show up at their performances, which they told me, you know, is beginning to happen. Milwaukee is sort of endlessly looking for new people to partner with, and sometimes that's the ballet for Romeo and Juliet or another performance. I think, yeah, it's really just sort of like they have the keys to a gold mine of people who are young, who don't have a lot of things tying them down, who have our professional jobs, and so that means some disposable income as well.
What is it? What's in it for those people? You know, the people who are actually members who go to these events. You know, why do they turn to groups like Milwaukee versus any other way of connecting with each other? You know, you're right that in the past, you know, churches might have filled this role.
Right. Yeah. Angela Damiani, who's the executive director of Milwaukee, started out as executive director of Art Milwaukee, and it's sort of a complicated story. And now, early in 2014, they're going to be trying to unveil new branding as everything falling under Milwaukee, and it's really one organization. As she described, as people are looking for some kind of in-person connection as organized religion falls away and church attendance goes down, are people looking to their jobs and employment as a way of building lateral ties, I guess, with your peers? And when I was at events, people were you had a number of people there who seemed like they showed up for most of the events, and they said they liked the crowd, and it was kind of a fun atmosphere. They tend to hire a local musician who will sing some songs, a few originals, a few covers, and then the bar will be happily filling drinks. And then not a certain subset of people weren't sure exactly why they were there or what they were there for. A certain number had heard about the event through work. A lot of these people were 25, didn't know a lot of people in town, or were a little confused. And sometimes it looked like they were meeting people there, and sometimes it looked like they were continuing to flounder. But I guess that's the way it goes.
Well, and you're right. You know, the Milwaukee sounds like it's representative of a national phenomenon of organizations like this.
Right. It's somewhat peculiar to explain. 7-8 years ago, you first started to hear things about young professional NYP groups. And it's really, I don't know, do you remember 20, 30 years ago?
No,
not
at all.
Such a phenomenon. Yeah, and people.
I mean, it's the kind of thing that maybe, if not churches, you know, this is what groups like, you know, the Rotary Club or the Kiwanis Club, I mean, the fraternal organizations might have filled.
Right, right. And I went to a downtown Rotary Club meeting, and when I was doing the reporting, things were a little more regimented. You meet at lunchtime on Tuesdays. It's a very constrained time period. So if you have kids, you have a job that. You know, you have to show up at 8 a.m. the next day and be back and, you know, ready to go that afternoon, then it sort of catered to those needs.
Well, and so maybe if Rotary and that kind of organization are at one end of the spectrum and a group like Milwaukee is at the maybe, if not the opposite end, certainly a different part of the spectrum, where does a group like Fuel Milwaukee fit in? Is that somewhere in the middle?
Their members are somewhat older. They do fit in the middle. And the events tend to be a little more conservative. People aren't cutting loose as much as how they described it to me. And you have more mixing of generations. Part of the danger and what seemed to be playing out in the events that I went to, the Milwaukee, you have – because it's loud to a degree and it's social to a degree, which is really what they emphasize, becoming friends first and then maybe we'll do business later. You have large segments of the population who just like really aren't interested in going to a bar and shouting for the next 3 hours. You know, that may have stopped being appealing 10, 15 years ago. So that a lot of the wisdom is sort of not getting into the room. You may have more of that at a Fuel event. That's one of the challenges of YP is how do we get people who have actually been civic leaders for, 20 years or have been around the block a few times. How do they get involved?
Well, and you're right. There are also some people who are concerned about the competition that exists between these YP groups. So what's the upshot of the competition? And you know, how would you characterize the competition between a group like Fuel Milwaukee and a group like Milwaukee?
Fuel and Milwaukee have bounced off each other. They sort of coexist now. And some people think that we should have more unity and that what that ends up usually coming down to is more people throwing their weight behind Milwaukee and being vocal, which isn't necessarily going to happen. And I didn't see the most. I mean, I guess people are quick to point out, oh, we support their events. When Milwaukee did its last YP week, which is one of its big signature programs, Fuel didn't hold any events that week and encouraged their members to go attend the other.
They're not necessarily event. Competing for membership dollars or business in this case.
Right. They're competing to a degree for attention. Fuel was quick to point out to me that they have the largest paid membership base and that they actually have paid members and a list that they can provide you. Not that they sell out their list. Which Milwaukee also said, we do not sell out our list. Absolutely not. And I guess there's a degree of trust when you give your email and contact info nowadays.
Well, and you know, one of the things that you write about is that the Milwaukee isn't even necessarily sure where it's going. There's this issue about whether they're a nonprofit, whether they're a company, what direction the organization is moving. How is that likely to iron itself out in the days ahead?
It was my sense that them portraying themselves as a nonprofit is going to largely fall by the wayside. Last I spoke with Angelus, he said, we're not sure what we're going to do. Art Milwaukee's Facebook page used to describe them as a nonprofit arts advocacy organization. At some point when I was doing the story and started asking questions about this, the word nonprofit came down and it got rewritten. This is also around the time they were doing all this rebranding stuff and how are we going to depict ourselves as Milwaukee. Yeah, there's such a thing in other states, I was told, called an L3C. And I'm not sure if it's an actual legal status, but a sort of a low-profit, civically-minded company that makes money, and it's not a nonprofit, but they have sort of a social mission, which is where Milwaukee is headed. I spoke to members of their creative committee who actually, at least one person who thought they were a 501c3, but they're not. most of their legal entities don't lend themselves to being set up as a nonprofit.
The YP phenomenon is a fairly new one, and one gets the sense from this article and from what they told you that the group is maybe kind of inventing things as they go along.
They admit we're sort of making this up as we go along, and what seems to drive them forward is the sheer number of people they get to turn out. The first urban island party they did out on
Lakeshore Park.
Right. The state park just east of the Summerfest grounds drew out way more people than they expected. To a degree, there's sort of a movement looking for a cause sometimes. So they get more, they have more people behind them than they than they may necessarily have ideas.
Well, Matt Rohde, thank you so much for giving us some insight into this.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Matt Rohde's article on Milwaukee is called Fountain of Youth, and it'll be in the December issue of Milwaukee Magazine, which goes out to subscribers next week and hits newsstands December 2nd. Matt Rohde is associate editor at the magazine. In the conversation about new leadership in Milwaukee, it's sometimes easy to forget that there is still plenty of institutional memory in this city. Lake Effect essayist Avi Lank notes the passing of one important name from the scene.
Mitchell Fronstein died recently at the age of 85. History's currents are broader than the life of a single individual, but Fronstein's life certainly captured an era in Milwaukee. Mitch, as Fronstein was called by those of us who were lucky enough to have known him, was a Milwaukeean through and through, a graduate of Sherwood High School in UW-Madison, who spent a few years outside the state, but built his career here and fashioned a legacy that has enriched us all. His biggest lasting accomplishment took place in the 1980s when, as leader of the Manpower Organization, he took the company public, was ousted when it was a victim of a hostile takeover by a British concern, and then engineered a reverse coup by ousting the Brits in turn. Eventually, he brought the company back to Milwaukee. Prior to all of that, he had offered me a job at Manpower, which I declined, to stick to journalism. Several years later, I was lucky enough to be the lead reporter on the British brouhaha for the old Milwaukee Sentinel. I can still remember talking to Mitch in 1989 as the story was hitting its climax. This was long before the internet or Skype, at a time when a phone call from Milwaukee to New York City was an event to remember. But there was Mitch, in a limousine in London, and me, sitting in a cramped, scruffy newsroom on North 4th Street in Milwaukee, exchanging information. Before we hung up, both of us commented on how unusual that was. I got a great story out of it, and eventually, Milwaukee got back a corporate headquarters, which now stands proudly on the west bank of the river downtown. Mitch and Manpower were part of a transformation of the Milwaukee economy after World War II that saw the emergence of a vigorous service sector, Manpower and Magic Investment Corp being the best examples. It was also the era when Major League Sports came to Milwaukee. Mitch was among those in the effort to start the Milwaukee Bucks in 1968. In many ways, it was around then that Milwaukee was at its peak economically, with the robust new service sector complementing an already powerful manufacturing base, companies such as Allen Bradley and Alice Chalmers, which had done so much to help the Allies win World War II. Within a few decades, the forces of globalization and the information revolution combined to sap the strength of this industrial juggernaut, while the service sector prospered for the most part. If you are looking for a symbol of all this, consider the fate of the Bucks. In a nicely ironic turn of events, the franchise was probably saved for the city in 1988 when money from the sale of the old industrial mainstay Allen Bradley to Rockwell International was used to build a new arena for the team, right across the street from where Mitch and I would have our transatlantic conversation. Now, the Bradley Center has been deemed too old-fashioned for an NBA team, and there is a real danger the city will lose the Bucks if millions are not invested in either it or a new arena. The situation is another sign of Milwaukee's relatively waning economic fortune. I never asked Mitch what he thought of this turn of events, but I know he was vital until the end, even giving counsel to the leader of a large local charity in the month before his death. Now his wisdom, along with the foresight and intelligence that built a billion-dollar global company and allowed for many quiet charitable contributions, is lost to us all. What is needed is the rise of a new generation of civic leadership that will infuse a third wave of economic vigor into the community to follow the strong core that was built by manufacturers before World War II, and a cadre of creative, hungry entrepreneurs such as Mitch following it. If that happens, I am sure no one would have been happier about it than Mitchell Fromstein.
Lake Effect essayist Avram Lank was an award-winning reporter and columnist at the Milwaukee Sentinel and Journal Sentinel for more than three decades. He lives in Whitefish Bay, and his freelance work has appeared in a variety of publications. One last break, and then we'll meet Irish stand-up comic Dylan Moran, who has gained fans on both sides of the Atlantic. He'll talk about appealing to audiences globally when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. If you set out to name five current stand-up comedians, the name Dylan Moran might not make your list, unless you are a fan of the 2004 cult movie hit Shaun of the Dead or the obscure BBC TV show Black Books, which had a three-season run about a decade ago. Despite his dabbling in movies and TV, Irish comedian Dylan Moran remains a staple of the stand-up circuit on a global level. His humor is observational, things like relationships and culture. Here's a sample.
Because they're afraid of a woman's contempt. And women, as a group, en masse, do show contempt for men, en masse. Now, a woman might be afraid of an individual violent man, which is very sensible. Everybody should be afraid of an individual violent man. But as a group, you hear a lot of contempt about men. Oh, look, look at them. Look, there they go. One of them is trying to do something.
Dylan Moran was in Milwaukee this fall for a show at Turner Hall Ballroom, and the stand-up comedian sat down with our own in-house yuckster, Dan Harmon, and talked about his early days in the business.
Well, before I did Black Books, I was a circuit stand-up in London, where you have to go to learn how to do it, really. I was there for about 4 years, and so doing sometimes two, three shows a night all over the city, jumping on buses, jumping in cabs to get to the next show. And it's noisy and rowdy, and you have to do a lot of crowd control, and you have to be sort of tolerant and not afraid of failing, because that happened, a few times. It does if you're doing probably, I don't know, hundreds of performances a year. And, you get toughened up, and you get used to shouting at people and being shouted at and not really minding too much. And everybody does it for a couple of years, and then they want to get the hell out of there. And you really do, because when I began, there were names who were doing it had been doing it for 10 or 15 years. And when I left, they're still doing it. And I see their names, some same names in the lists. And that was kind of the thing you were afraid of. You didn't want to stay on that circuit because you can. There are cases where you just don't get out. So my agent said to me, come on, write something. And I submitted a script for a sitcom festival, and then people liked it. It got picked up. We made people laugh. They said, okay, let's make this program. I mean, that was it. You know, there was no big run-up. There was no plan. I never had a plan.
Nor did you have a desire to be a bookstore owner or work in
a shop? That idea just came from spending quite a lot of time in these places and noticing that all the guys who were in there looked like they just had some sort of, digestive problem.
All right. Well, I don't know. Maybe it played sort of a prominent role in the series, but I just want your take on how much drinking and alcohol plays a part in your comedy.
Well, I grew up in Ireland in the 70s, so these were unreconstructed times. This is before, it's not like America where, there's health warnings on plastic spoons saying plastic spoons can damage your health if you stick them in your ear. Ireland was one of those places where people routinely imbibed huge quantities of alcohol and then flung themselves into cars to do long and arduous cross-country journeys. So that was just part of the culture, different times. And it was around, it's part of the culture. It's around, and it was also around in those sort of semi-bohemian or rackety environments in London, where a lot of those bookshops were too. Kind of a down at heel, seedy, not very competitive or glamorous or a success-led kind of way of living, just people trying to inch along to the next day or the next week and blotting themselves out with cheap Spanish red wine at the end of the day.
So how much of that character was you?
You use bits of yourself in it, whatever you're doing, but when it comes to those characters, you know, they're so heightened, they're so exaggerated. It's a character. You know, this is very important to understand. I'm sometimes surprised people still ask, you know, how much of it is you, because yes, you know, I've got black hair or brown hair or whatever color my hair is, and I sit in chairs and I read and I can drink some wine, but there's not a huge crossover because the character's nuts. If you live like that, you'd be dead very quickly.
Well, I mean, did it give you a chance to further hone your craft, I guess? I mean, completely different style of writing than stand-up?
Yeah, well, I'd always been writing different things. I'd always been writing bits of prose and bits of plays and all kinds of stuff, you know, so I wasn't starting from nothing, you know? Yeah, it gave me a chance to work with great people. And because I was so involved in the making of the program and because I was worried about the scripts and would these jokes go over and so on, I didn't worry about acting. I was never very interested in acting, to be honest. I never thought about it very much. I just sort of turned up and tried to make sure that we hit the jokes the way they were intended to work. So it meant that I was relaxed about performing because I was too worried about the show, if you know what I mean.
Well, it looks like you guys had a lot of fun doing it, though.
We did have a lot of fun doing it. I mean, I was very lucky. You know, I was working with really stellar talents there with Bill and Tamsin. They're exceptional people.
Well, you just mentioned acting. So did it give you a further opinion of whether or not you wanted to keep doing stand-up? I mean, obviously you have kept doing it since then.
Yeah, that's because I like eating. And being able to buy socks, you know, I wouldn't exaggerate the level of choice I have in all of this. You know, one has to live. And look, it's a really interesting way to live. You get to travel around. If it wasn't for what I do, I would never have ended up in Milwaukee, for instance. I would never have had a chance to walk your empty, empty, lonely streets.
All right. Well, it's just my opinion anyway, and I don't know. I think comedians are uniquely qualified to comment on culture. You have to be a cultural observationalist. So what are your current observations?
Well, I'm looking at where I am and what's going on. So obviously my head is full of America at the moment, trying to figure out why it's working or not working the way it is just at present. It does seem to be in a really interesting, if crazy, phase with your very infantile obstructionist politics going on. I'm not sure how much longer that can last. The Republicans are in a deeply hilarious phase as far as I'm concerned. They're more and more extreme, more and more aggressive, and less and less forthcoming with anything that resembles an idea. So I just want to see how far they can take it. I mean, fully expecting people to be jumping up and down and tearing off their shirts and throwing them across the room quite soon.
It seems like you haven't really spent too much time focusing on American culture, American politics in your stand-up routines. Some of it, but I'm wondering if...
Yeah, well, I'm especially interested in, not exclusively, but especially interested in sort of, you know, how we see each other from across the Atlantic, or how Americans think of the other parts of Europe apart from Britain and Ireland. And, you know, everybody talks about America. That's probably one of the unique aspects of the country. Not everybody's talking about Britain or France or Japan, you know, but everybody talks about America, because if you scratch your left ear, it has big consequences all around the world. So you're the only ones in that position, and sometimes I think Americans are a bit freaked out by the extremity of reaction that everybody has about them. But that's because you are in the one remaining empire on the planet, so it really matters. It may not feel like an empire at home, but believe me, it does in Europe and lots of other parts of the world. We all care about America and what America is up to.
Well, at the same time, it gives you a lot more material.
Yeah.
I would hope so, anyway.
Yeah, well, you've given us endless material over the years. You continue to provide material at an astonishing rate. You know, the country is completely bewildering in its immensity and scale. And like I say, those consequences of something very small at home I really don't think Americans understand that, how gripped everybody else is, how everybody watches and wonders what America is going to do next. It really is the kind of the first person almost you consult in world theater. That's the character you're watching, because they're the protagonist in lots of ways, and everything they do is going to affect everybody else on the stage. Which is, I suppose, a very unwanted position for a lot of Americans. They just want to get on with their lives. They're thinking about what's in front of them. And it must be a bit of a burden, actually.
But with suicide bombers, one of the things I don't understand is, what's in it for the women suicide bombers? Because with the men, you know, it's a very male kind of promise at the end of it, 72 virgins. A man, I think, thought of that. And but I bet you what women are offered is much more modest. It's probably, you know, flexible working hours and decent childcare at the end of it, something like that. Look at Vladimir Putin. How can he cultivates the idea of being a gangster? He just loves it. How can you trust anybody who looks like they've been cloned from a dead shark? Or Berlusconi in Italy, right? The envy of the world, Italy, in terms of history, art and culture. 98 different political parties, and they still managed to elect him. He's so crooked, he sleeps on a spiral staircase.
What are some of your favorite targets, if you will?
Well, you know, I don't know if I call them targets, because I'm not interested in attacking something for its own sake. I'm interested in what I'm interested in, and what I'm interested in tends to be my own life, my own experience, and what I see intersects or overlaps with what I imagine most people's experience is, because I have to deal with what's universal. I'm traveling around in all these different zones, you know, from Britain to Poland to Germany to Russia to America or Australia. So these are all, you know, fairly different environments in some ways. Some are superficial and not and trivial, and some quite important. So I'm always drawn to the constants, you know, what people are talking around as they sit around their kitchen table, how people are dealing with children. What, I mean, if you look at the concerns of people all around the world, you know, say, just to go back to politics for a second, when all the politicians are out there before an election, what people are worried about is all the very, very obvious stuff that they mention all the time: their energy bills, feeding and clothing their families, educating their kids, their children having a better experience than themselves. That's really it, you know, most of the time for most people. So that inevitably a lot of what you talk about is going to be around those areas, because that's where all our big myths and stories come from. You know, father figures and mother figures and the lover and the somebody who eloped. And it's these are the dramas of our lives that are played out in our kitchens and bedrooms. You know, it's not world consequential stuff. It's domestic drama, a lot of it.
Which country is least able to take a joke?
That's a good question, because there are places that are far more sensitive. I mean, Americans are actually fairly sensitive about what you say about them. And I always think that's very interesting, because you are such a strong country that there is this, you know, there's a lot of jingoism and a lot of insecurity, which is strange because you are so immensely powerful. But I think that's because there's a lot of self-doubt, actually, in America. And that's why you get these affirmations all the time. I'm always, you know, I always say this, I'm amazed at the amount of American movies. There was a big run of them recently where in the last reel, the character who's the president will be making some speech that always ends with the phrase, the American people, or, you know, because of the indomitable spirit of the American people. There's a load of those movies, you know, where the White House was attacked or something like that. That features seems to loom large in people's imaginations at the moment in America. They feel like some sort of jig is up, or, you know, they're going to be called out or something like that. It seems to worry them. But, you know, there's lots of sensitivities. Like if you go, I was in Germany, you know, so I'm talking of people, you're talking in English, people are sitting there, you know, they're thinking, what's he going to say about the war, about the Second World War? I was in Serbia last week, and certainly one way to get people's attention in a theater in Serbia is to say, you know, in the rest of Europe, whenever Serbia comes up, we always say, that if you just say that to get that far, you won't hear a pin drop in the house. So yeah, everybody's concerned about what everybody else thinks about them, is what I would say. You know, they're interested in what their neighbors say about them, or what their enemies have said about them over the years. I was in Kazakhstan and I said, you know, everybody laughs at somebody, so who do you laugh at here? And as one, the audience shouted out Kazakhstan, which I thought was very funny.
Well, why do you think there are not more Irish comedians.
Why do I think there are not more? Well, there are plenty. Do you want more? Do you want me to
sure.
Do you want me to call some people? Is this not working out for you?
I just want more.
There are actually plenty. I'm sure there are sites that people like you can go to.
Okay. Well, I think you're the one that has achieved the most notoriety.
Well, yeah. I don't know. I don't have a notoriety measuring instrument, but I know I've got around a bit for sure.
Yeah. When you decide on material for your routines, are you just constantly taking notes? Or are you just looking at everything?
I do take notes where and when I can. It can be hard when you're traveling, but I do try to take notes because often something will come to you and then it's gone and you won't get it back. It is anything and everything. You know, I scan newspapers, I talk to people. I find talking to people quite productive, actually, because you're speaking to someone who's in situ and dealing with that particular city, and they can tell you what's going on and what the big news was recently. And everybody's got an opinion. You don't have to force it out of people most of the time. The only time it's not really productive if somebody's trying to big up the place or sell you their city in some sort of touristy way. But if people just tell you what it's like to live there, it's always interesting.
Just as a last question, can you tell us about your deal with ABC Television?
I can tell you that I have a deal with ABC Television. Yeah. I'm going to deliver a pilot for a show before Thanksgiving, I think. And it's sort of set in and around, it's got to do with media and conflict. That's about as much as I can really say.
All right.
Modern news reporting.
Okay. We have some ideas here if you're looking for them.
Okay. All right.
All right. Dylan Moran, thank you for coming on.
Thank you very much.
I live in Scotland. Have you been to Scotland? See, that's the exact same number of people as answered that question in the affirmative when I ask it in England. And English people don't go up there. It's nearly half the country and they don't go up. And you say, why don't you go? And they go, oh, well, you know, it's very dark and dreary. Because they get so used to the crocodiles and the tropical storms down there in England. And they... Dark and dreary, you can't understand the accent, the food's disgusting. A lot of violence, a lot of drugs, people injecting temazepam into each other's stumps. And otherwise, I go, you know. And
Irish comedian Dylan Moran chatted with Dan Harmon before a show recently at Turner Hall Ballroom. You'll find a link to more about Dylan Moran from wuwm.com/legeffect. That's Thursday's edition of the program. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock, and I sure hope you can keep listening because fresh air comes your way next. Stay tuned.